Hello and welcome to Historical True Crime, the podcast where we take a look back at history's darkest crimes and criminals. I'm your host, Lizzie, and today is episode 71. We'll be diving into another one of the most notorious cases of the 20th century, the chilling story of Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb. Imagine Chicago in the 1920s, speakeasies, jazz music, and a city full of activity. However, beneath all of the glamour and flash, a dark scheme was hatching that would shock the country and change the way people thought about crime and punishment forever. It took a lot to shock the U.S. in the 1920s. The nation was still reeling from the aftermath of the First World War. There was a sharp rise in violent organized crime during the Prohibition era, and two of the worst economic downturns in history occurred, the Wall Street Crash of 1929 and the Forgotten Depression of 1920 to 1921. But here come Richard Loeb and Nathan Leopold, two well-off and bright young men whose names would later be associated with cruelty and evil. Together, Leopold and Loeb hatched a plan so audacious, so cold-blooded, that it would send shockwaves through society. Their goal? To commit the perfect crime. A crime so flawless, it would prove their superiority over mere mortals. But what drove these privileged young men to such extremes? And how did their twisted desires ultimately lead to their downfall? Well, join me as we peel back the layers of deception and dive into the minds of two of history's most infamous criminals. This is the chilling tale of Leopold and Loeb, a story of privilege, obsession, and the dark allure of forbidden desires. According to Bats for SmithsonianMag.com, Loeb first met Leopold in the summer of 1920. Kenwood, a posh Jewish suburb on Chicago's south side, was the boy's childhood home. At the age of 15, Leopold, a gifted student, would enroll in the University of Chicago. In addition, he distinguished himself as an amateur ornithologist by writing two papers in the top American ornithological publication. His family had connections and was well off. His father was a shrewd businessman who had inherited a shipping company and turned his first fortune in paper box and aluminum can manufacturing into a second one. When Leopold, then 19, would enroll in the University of Chicago to study law in 1924, everyone anticipated he would have a distinguished and honorable career. 18-year-old Richard Loeb was from a privileged background as well. His father made an estimated $10 million fortune as a vice president of Sears Roebuck and Company. Loeb, the third child in a family of four boys, had already made a name for himself. He graduated from high school at the age of 14 and enrolled in the University of Chicago in that same year. But he would not have a pleasant university experience. Loeb received merely average grades, and his classmates were many years older than him. He would transfer to the University of Michigan at the end of his sophomore year, where he continued to be a mediocre student who preferred to read dime novels and play cards over attending classes. And through his time at Ann Arbor, he would develop an alcohol problem. He did, however, manage to graduate from Michigan, and he returned to Chicago in 1924 to enroll in graduate-level history classes at the university. After Loeb returned to Chicago in the fall of 1923, the two young men rekindled their connection. Despite their initial differences, Leopold was distant and misanthropic, while Loeb was outgoing and gregarious. The pair would quickly grow close. And the more Leopold got to know Loeb, the more the other boy drew him in. Loeb had an effortless, approachable charm. He was tall, thin, but well-built, with brown blonde hair, amusing eyes, and an alluring smile that could happen at any moment. The fact that Loeb would frequently engage in mindless destructive actions, such as car theft, arson, and storefront window smashing, did nothing to lessen Leopold's longing for Loeb's company. Leopold, though, was fascinated by psychology, especially the idea that German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche proposed about Übermenschen, or supermen. According to Nietzsche, some people in society were transcendent, gifted with great powers, and intellectually superior. Leopold soon came to believe that he was one of these supermen, and thus not subject to social norms or morality. He would never stop talking about the legendary Superman who, by virtue of his superpowers, was above the law, and any morality that might restrain the behavior of regular people. Leopold asserted that if committing murder provided a superhuman joy, then it was appropriate for him to do so. Morality was irrelevant in this situation. He eventually persuaded Loeb that he, in fact, was a Superman as well, and the two began to steal small things to test their apparent immunity. They stole a typewriter, a camera, and penknives from a fraternity home at the university. They would then turn to arson when their theft failed to get any attention. But these small petty crimes wouldn't be enough, and the pair would hyper-focus on committing what they thought would be the perfect crime. Reminder that Leopold and Loeb at this time were only 19 and 18 respectively, but they decided that kidnapping and murdering a young teenager would be the ideal crime. Everything, including the method of kidnapping and the disposal of the body, was planned over a period of 7 months. They chose to demand a ransom in order to conceal the true nature of their crime and motivation. Then they came up with a convoluted strategy to obtain the ransom, which included a lengthy list of intricate instructions that had to be given over the phone, one set at a time. They would use the typewriter they stole from the fraternity home to type the last set of instructions for the actual money drop. They purchased a weapon, a chisel. They also bought a rope, which they intended to tie around their victim's neck and pull on opposite ends to strangle him to death, so that each of them would bear equal responsibility for the murder. But the toughest part of all was finding the perfect target. Following an extensive hunt, primarily on the campus of the Harvard School for Boys in the Kenwood neighborhood, where Leopold had received his education, the two would ultimately settle on 14-year-old Robert Bobby Franks, the son of affluent Chicago watchmaker Jacob Franks, who happened to be Loeb's neighbor, and Bobby had in fact even played tennis at the Loeb home. On May 21, 1924 in the afternoon, Leopold and Loeb carried out their plan. They offered to drive Bobby home from school in a car that Leopold had rented under the name of Morton D. Ballard. But because his destination was less than 2 blocks away, Bobby at first would refuse. But Loeb convinced him to get in the car so they could talk about a tennis racket he had been using. The exact order of what happened next is still up for debate. But most people agree that Leopold drove the car while Loeb took the back seat with the chisel. Bobby was in the front seat of the passenger side when Loeb would hit him in the head with the chisel, pulling him to the rear seat and strangling him until he died. They would then drive to Wolf Lake, which is about 25 miles outside of Chicago, with Bobby's body on the floor of the car. His clothes were then removed and the body was hidden by some train tracks. They would cover his face and his stomach, which had a scar that could identify him, with hydrochloric acid. After that, they drove back to Chicago, acting like nothing had happened. Leopold would call Bobby's mother, identifying himself as George Johnson, and tell her that Bobby had been kidnapped. Instructions for delivering the ransom would follow. Then they burnt the typewriter used to make the ransom note, mailed it, and carried on with their lives. Leopold would call again and deliver the first set of instructions for the ransom payment, after the Franks family received the ransom note that next morning. When a worried family member misplaced the address of the store where he was meant to receive the next set of instructions, the elaborate plan would quickly break down, and it would be abandoned when word came that Bobby's body had been discovered. Investigators would examine the ransom note in an effort to identify the criminals, and they would conclude it was written by a person with a more than ordinary education. Additionally, analysts were able to link the type to a particular typewriter. The most important clue, though, was found right next to Bobby's body, a set of glasses made by a Brooklyn-based business that had a unique hinge. Through investigation, those glasses were linked to only 3 possible owners, one of them being Leopold. Date's attorney, Robert Crow, then brought Leopold in for interrogation. When asked, he suggested that it was possible he had dropped his glasses the weekend before while out bird watching. But on May 29th, Leopold and Loeb were called in for official interrogation. They claimed that the night of the murder, they had driven Leopold's car to pick up two women in Chicago, where they left them near a golf club and never asked what the women's last names were. When Leopold's driver reported to police that he was actually fixing Leopold's car when the men claimed to be driving it, their alibi was revealed to be a lie. The typewriter that Leopold and Loeb had destroyed was found in Jackson Park Lagoon on June 7th. And ultimately, the pair would confess to the crime and show a startling lack of empathy for their victim. Bobby was virtually an afterthought. Despite the fact that they had meticulously planned and prepared for the crime, Bobby was just an easy target, that's all. According to Leibarger for the Paris Review, Nina Barrett's book, The Leopold and Loeb Files, uses original historical documents, which had been stored in the law school basement at Northwestern University until 1988, to bring the murderers' voices back to life. Barrett's book combines editorialized and frequently sensationalized text from newspapers with scans of original source materials. Reading the transcripts of Leopold and Loeb is fascinating because they repeatedly backtrack, contradict, and double down in their convoluted arguments. Here's an example of the lack of remorse from Loeb. Question: when was the first you felt remorse? Loeb: I felt sorry about the thing, about the killing of the boy. Oh, well, that very night. But then the excitement, the accounts in the paper, the fact that we had gotten away with it, and that they did not suspect us, that it was given so much publicity, and all that sort of thing, naturally went to the question of not feeling as much remorse as otherwise I think I would have. And Loeb would be the first to fold. He asserted that Leopold was both the murderer and the mastermind behind everything. Leopold would claim to police that Loeb was Bobby Frank's killer, even though it had been his idea. In the end, they both acknowledged that their primary motivation had been excitement, attributing their actions to their desire to commit the ideal crime and their Superman illusions. Newspapers would splatter the details of the crime all over their front pages as soon as Leopold and Loeb were arrested. Articles raised the obvious question: how could two young men who seem so honorable and upright be accountable for something so senseless? The term dementia jazzmania was first used by the Chicago Daily Journal to characterize the men's hedonistic, immoral way of life. The salaciousness of the crime was fueled by rumors about the men's personal and sexual relationship. Their wealth and Jewish heritage became fuel for anti-Semitism. The parents of Leopold and Loeb didn't cut any corners when building out their defense team. They would engage the services of Benjamin Bachrock and Clarence Darrow, who would later defend John T. Scopes, a high school teacher, in the Scopes monkey trial. Darrow had the most to bear in terms of legal strategy. Since they had both confessed, he wasn't able to prove their innocence. There was no evidence that anyone had coerced them into making their confessions. So would Darrow argue that insanity absolved them of their guilt? Well, there was a problem with this argument as well. Leopold and Loeb seemed quite clear-cut and logical. The inability to discriminate between right and wrong was the acknowledged standard in Illinois courts, and both boys met this standard. Leopold and Loeb were persuaded to plead guilty by Darrow. His intention was to keep them from being executed, and he believed that his clients would benefit from a bench trial presided over by Judge John R. Caverly. From this point on, Caverly would chair a hearing to decide on punishment, which could include anything from the death penalty to a minimum of 14 years in jail. It's obvious that Darrow would have preferred to present his case before a single judge, as opposed to a group of 12 jurors, who may have been more swayed by divisive remarks and public opinion. All Darrow had to do now was convince the judge that they were mentally ill, which is a medical condition that was not equal to or similar to insanity, in order to get the boys' sentences reduced. And Darrow's case would be won if he could prevent his client's death by hanging. The hearing or trial would prove to be a media spectacle. It was one of the first cases in the U.S. to be dubbed the trial of the century. Using the testimony of four psychiatrists who were dubbed alienists at the time, the defense sought to strengthen its case against the death penalty. Now, both sides, the defense and prosecution, would recruit the greatest psychiatric experts 1924 had to offer to evaluate the defendants. Sigmund Freud was even invited to attend the trial in Chicago, but his health at the time prevented the trip. The defense would vehemently maintain that evidence of mental illness should be taken into account as a mitigating factor when determining the defendant's sentences, while the prosecution contended that psychiatric testimony was only admissible if the defendants claimed insanity. Judge Calverley would overrule the state's objection in the trial's most important decision, allowing the introduction of psychiatric evidence. According to FamousTrials.com, Leopold and Loeb's hearing would last slightly longer than 1 month. Psychiatric evidence detailing the defendant's emotional immaturity, obsessions with crime, and Nietzschean philosophy, alcohol addiction, anomalies of the glands, and sexual longings and insecurities were submitted by the defense. William White, the defense psychiatrist, stated in court that Leopold's pathology began in early childhood. Leopold was tormented nonstop, becoming estranged from his peers, a lonely, unhappy child who withdrew into an inner world where intelligence was all that mattered and emotion was nothing. Trapped inside his world of fantasy, Leopold imagined himself a slave who saved the life of his king, Loeb, and thereby had earned the king's gratitude. Another defense psychiatrist, Bernard Gluck, testified Leopold adhered to a purely hedonistic philosophy that all action was justified if it gave pleasure. He said Leopold's ambition was to become the perfect Nietzschean and to follow Nietzsche's philosophy all the way through. According to this psychiatrist, Leopold had told him he was jealous of the food and drink that Loeb took because he could not come as close to him as did the food and drink. He concluded that Leopold had a definitely paranoid personality and was given to a delusional way of thinking. William White would characterize Loeb's main outstanding feature as infantilism. Loeb, according to White, was still a little child emotionally, talking to his teddy bear. It was suggested that Loeb's classmates and associates, who were witnesses, provided evidence of his aggressive behavior, inappropriate laughter, lack of judgment, and childness. Additional witnesses attested to Leopold's argumentative style and egotism. Crow, for the prosecution, had also enlisted prominent psychiatrists. Prosecution psychiatrists had a different opinion, which was not surprising. They included Archibald Church, a professor of mental illness and medical jurisprudence at Northwestern University, Hugh Patrick, president of the American Neurological Association, and William Crone and Harold Singer, authors of Insanity and the Law, a treatise on forensic psychiatry. William Crone testified that, in my opinion, Richard Loeb was not suffering from any mental disease, either functional or structural, on May 21, 1924. According to Crone, there was abundant evidence that the man was perfectly oriented as to time, as to place, and as to his social relations. He came to the conclusion that Leopold was also free of any serious mental illness. There was no evidence of any organic disease of the brain, Crone stated. He showed remarkably close attention, detailed attention. The state produced more than 100 witnesses in addition to its expert testimony, proving, in the view of many, every aspect of the crime, albeit excessively. According to Batts for Smithsonian Mag, the psychiatrists representing the state and the defense each contradicted each other. Few onlookers could recognize that each side was uniquely justified in obtaining its decisions because it represented a distinct subspecialty of psychiatry. The defendant's cerebral cortex and central nervous system were found not to have been harmed by any organic trauma or infection, according to the state's expert witnesses, who were all neurologists. Thus, the doctors working for the prosecution came to the conclusion that there was no mental disease. The defense's psychiatrists could all reasonably claim that the defendants had experienced childhood mental trauma that had impaired each boy's capacity for competent functioning based on their knowledge of psychiatry, which was shaped by psychoanalysis. The majority of observers, however, were unaware of the divide between psychoanalytic psychiatry and neurology at the time. Now, at the end of the hearing, the best speech of Darrow's career was his passionate 8 or 12, depending on the source, hour masterful plea. Its main claims were that the American legal system's procedures and penalties were cruel, and the accused youth and immaturity. On September 10, 1924, around 9 in the morning, Calverley was ready to announce the sentence. On the last day of the hearing, crowds of Chicagoans gathered around radio sets to listen to a live broadcast of the hearing. The city had literally stopped its morning commotion to hear this decision. The judge would describe the murder as a crime of singular atrocity. He declared that it was beyond the province of this court to predict ultimate responsibility for human acts, adding that his judgment cannot be affected by the reasons behind crimes. However, Calverley stated that he was convinced that life in prison rather than death was the more appropriate punishment due to the consideration of the age of the defendants and the potential benefits to criminology from further research of them. To the offenders, particularly of the type they are, the prolonged years of confinement may be the severest form of retribution, he declared, claiming that he was doing them no favors. The prosecutor, Crow, was incensed with the judge's ruling. He made sure everyone understood who was at fault when he gave his news conference speech, saying, "The state's attorney's duty was fully performed. The judge alone is ultimately in charge of making the determination." But later that night, when he made another more incendiary statement, Crow's anger would come to the forefront of the public eye. Leopold and Loeb had the reputation of being immoral degenerates of the worst type. The evidence demonstrates that the two defendants are atheists and adherents of Nietzschean beliefs, believing that they are above the law, both human and divine laws. That they were not executed is regrettable for the community's well-being. At first, Leopold and Loeb were detained at Joliet Prison. The two were kept as far apart as possible, but they were able to maintain their friendship. Following an appendectomy, Leopold was moved to Stateville Penitentiary in 1925. And Loeb would follow in 1930. Following their reunion, the two would add a junior college and high school curriculum to the jail education system. But in 1936, despite the best efforts of the prison doctors, Loeb, who was 30 years old at the time, would pass away after being stabbed in the shower by James Day, a prisoner serving a term for Grand Theft Auto. Day claimed that Loeb had tried to rape him, but he came out of the scuffle unscathed, while Loeb had over 50 wounds, including self-defense cuts on his wrists and arms. After a brief trial in June 1936, a jury would find Day not guilty. Leopold would continue to pursue his education while incarcerated. He restructured the prison library, taught in the prison school, worked as an x-ray technician in the prison hospital, learned foreign languages, volunteered to be tested for an experimental malaria vaccine, and created a new prison education program. Following 34 years of incarceration, Leopold was freed from prison on parole in 1958. Settling in Puerto Rico under a pseudonym, Leopold attempted to find solace in academia once again, teaching mathematics to local students. Yet the shadows of his past loomed large, casting a long and unforgiving shadow over his every endeavor. In the later years of his life, Leopold grappled with the weight of his actions and would seek redemption through acts of philanthropy and penance. He dedicated himself to advocating for prison reform, using his own experience to shed light on the flaws within the criminal justice system. But Leopold would die in 1971 at the age of 66. From the moment their heinous crime shocked the world in 1924, the story of Leopold and Loeb has captured the imagination of filmmakers, writers, and artists alike. Their twisted tale of privilege, obsession, and murder has left its mark on popular culture. Perhaps the most famous cinematic portrayal of Leopold and Loeb's chilling crime comes from Alfred Hitchcock's 1948 masterpiece, Rope. Loosely based on the real-life events, this film follows two young men who commit murder simply for the thrill of it, mirroring the callousness and arrogance of the original perpetrators. In literature, the case has been dissected and reimagined countless times, with authors exploring the complex motivations and psychological underpinnings of Leopold and Loeb's actions. From Truman Capote's In Cold Blood to Meyer Levin's Compulsion, the case continues to serve as a source of inspiration for writers seeking to dive into the darker recesses of the human psyche. Even in the realm of television, Leopold and Loeb's story continues to captivate audiences, with episodes of crime dramas such as Law & Order and Criminal Minds drawing inspiration from the case. The Leopold and Loeb story continues to captivate and resonate deeply within the public consciousness, largely due to the complex intersection of societal norms, privilege, and the human condition. As historian Barrett astutely observes, the case unfolded against the backdrop of a society enamored with the idealized pursuit of happiness, where success and prosperity are perceived as the ultimate markers of fulfillment. Yet the shocking revelation of Leopold and Loeb's heinous crime shatters this illusion, exposing the fragility of the American dream in wealth, and the lurking darkness even within the most privileged echelons of society. Wealth cannot protect people from the depths of their own depravity, or from the consequences of their conduct in a society where wealth is frequently associated with virtue and stability. This case is still fascinating and intriguing today, but it serves as a reminder of how easily people's minds can be broken, and the lengths people can go to in order to fulfill their very worst fantasies. And with that, we'll come to the end of another episode of Historical True Crime. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you did, please remember to review, rate, subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can follow us on social media, on Instagram at Historical True Crime Pod or Facebook at Historical True Crime Podcast. And you can always reach out to us with any feedback or suggestions for upcoming episodes by email at historicaltruecrimepod@gmail.com. And we'll see you next week for another dark and notorious case from history. We'll see you then.